This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Welcome to Inside China, and welcome to the second of our two-part special on the two sessions, what we call the Liang Hui in Chinese. My name is Mimi Lau, and as you may have already heard, this year's annual parliamentary sessions were historic for a number of reasons. Starting with the fact that it has been postponed for months due to the pandemic, but more importantly, because this year, the two sessions meetings were dominated by two words, and I don't mean COVID-19.
The National People's Congress has approved plans for a controversial security law for Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
In this podcast, you're going to hear from three of my colleagues who have been covering the two sessions. Mai Jun is based in Beijing and has been doing the reporting on the ground from the Great Hall of the People for the past few years. But he has been having an entirely different kind of experience this year.
I would have to wait in a hotel room for about 7 hours or 8 hours just to wait for the result to come out.
And Teddy Ng, one of our China Desk editors, is going to bring you insights into the decision on the national security law for Hong Kong that's dominated international headlines.
A lot of people are asking whether this is still one country, two system, or one country, one system.
And Political Economy Desk editor Zhou Xin is going to analyze the economic crisis facing China and what the end of the five-year plan and Beijing's changing economic policy mean.
Some people are saying 200 million, and some even positive, optimistic estimate still says 50 to 60 million job losses. You know, that's huge. So that's something Beijing is really worried about.
A couple of years ago, Mai Jun was part of the SCMP team that broadcast what we are pretty sure was the first Facebook Live report from the outside of a security checkpoint at the Tiananmen Square right at the beginning of the two sessions. Don't ask how we did it, but we did, and you can still watch it on the SCMP Facebook page. This year, Mai Jun is part of another historic moment at the two sessions, but for entirely different reasons. To start with, normally the two sessions is a huge occasion, bringing journalists from across Asia and the rest of the world to Beijing. But not this year. And there are no news teams from Japan, South Korea, Europe, or anywhere else in the world coming to Beijing because of the pandemic. And this is what Mai Jun had to say about the experience for reporters on the ground who can get there.
I think the biggest difference is it is way more difficult for me to actually go to the Great Hall of the People where the delegates are meeting. In fact, I have not been admitted to any one of those events this year because what they do, what they're doing this year is they put a very tight cap of numbers of journalists that could be allowed into any of these sessions. There are dozens of journalists working for Hong Kong media who applied to go to, say, the opening ceremony of the National People's Congress meeting. And then we have to draw slots, and then like only 10 of us can make it to the event. So I was not lucky enough to go into any of those, but I am, I don't know whether to say lucky or not lucky. I was picked to go to the Premier's press conference, which will take place on Thursday afternoon, which happens immediately after the closing ceremony of the National People's Congress.
Now, as you have heard last week, one of the reasons why there is so much importance placed on the two sessions by foreign journalists is because it's pretty much the only time they can get access to officials that are otherwise impossible to reach for real insights into China policy. But not this year.
It's impossible for us to try to doorstep people and just to put a microphone in front of their hand. These people, they are very difficult for journalists to actually grab them throughout the rest of the year. So it used to be the only opportunity in a year for us to just confront these people. Hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And, you know, my favorites are usually the provincial governors and the mayors.
And the reason why Mai Jun could get access to this official is, how do I put it nicely, they don't really have a key to the executive bathrooms.
They're not senior enough to use their exclusive corridors. So they walked in just like everybody else. And then they are senior enough to say things that really matter. They, you know, they run provincial economies, or they drive important policies. But I cannot do it this year. So what I do and what most of our colleagues do from Beijing is just need to watch the television, you know, see the transcript handed out by the press officers, and maybe, you know, play around with their, you know, press system a little bit to see if we miss, you know, quotes here and there. And so it's a very entirely different experience.
Now, even though he couldn't stick out the bathrooms in the hope of catching an official for a doorstep interview, Mai Jun was still able to catch a very significant and symbolic moment, and it involved China's President Xi Jinping.
Yeah, I think that moment from Tuesday was very interesting, because I've done the so-called bird watching at the Great Hall of the People for a couple of years.
Bird watching?
Bird watching is we stood at the press, you know, the press seats, but we watch what's happening among the most senior leaders, state leaders. We know if they talk to each other at all, who talked to whom, who shook hands with whom, and all that kind of interactions. But obviously, we're not able to do it this year because of all the pandemic. So I saw this picture from our colleagues, a colleague in Ming Pao Daily, which is also a Hong Kong-based newspaper. And then they reported that after the session from yesterday ended, Xi Jinping was just trying to exit the podium when he stopped and exchanged a few words with Xia Baolong, which is Beijing's new appointment on Hong Kong policies. And that was very interesting because it does not happen a lot. And usually what happens is after the end of a session, Xi Jinping would just walk straight out, and then everybody would be waiting on their seats, and they would only start moving after people who rank, you know, who are more senior than them have already left or are on their way to probably follow in a line. So that was very obvious.
Mai Jun explains why it is so important to remember President Xi Jinping make this kind of gesture, because he's got the power to call a closed-door meeting whenever he likes and be sure these people would always be available. And maybe it was more than just a signal to the media?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, he was not only, President Xi Jinping's not only showing his support or endorsement in front of the eyes of the journalist, he's also doing it in front of, more than 2,000 members of the National People's Congress. And he's also doing it in front of the diplomats who happen to be there. You know, because usually they would invite dozens of diplomats from other countries, you know, who are from different embassies that are based in Beijing to just watch those kind of sessions. I think it's a signal that she, you know, intentionally sent out in strong support of Xia Baolong.
There's another thing you should know about the two sessions. You might be thinking this huge event for China ends with a big speech from President Xi Jinping, but it doesn't.
The two sessions will be finished after the lawmakers, you know, casted votes on a couple of laws and resolutions. And then at the end of it, the premier will move on to another room and to take questions from the press. And so by the time that our audience are listening to this podcast, the two sessions might have well been over. And the interesting is the two sessions do not end with any speech by Xi Jinping. Under China's political system, the power of the president is actually very, very limited. Xi Jinping's power mostly came from the Communist Party. But if we look at the constitution of China, it looks much more like a parliamentary system in which a premier has a lot of power. So Premier Li Keqiang will be the one who's wrapping up the sessions. And we'll see what he's going to talk about tomorrow.
Now, before I get Teddy in the studio to talk about what was said and what was not said in a speech by China's Premier Li Keqiang, here's one more insight into what it was like to try and cover the two sessions in the year 2020. Normally, the press conference from China's premier is a highly organized affair with scheduled questions from journalists from different countries and media outlets. But this year's closing ceremony press conference with Li Keqiang had even stricter controls. This is what Mai Jun had to look forward to after having been selected in a lottery for journalists who get to attend the press conference with Li Keqiang to close the two sessions.
I have to go at the designated hotel at around 6 in the morning to get tested for COVID-19. And I would have to wait in a hotel room for about 7 hours or 8 hours just to wait for the result to come out. So during that entire period of 7 hours, 8 hours, I cannot leave the hotel room so that, you know, the result can be accounted for as accurate. And then only after I am confirmed negative can I go to a press center where the journalists will all be for the press conference.
So with me here today is Teddy Ng, one of our China Desk editor. Can you briefly explain some of the background of the national security law? What does it mean for Hong Kong as of now?
Well, the Nationalist People's Congress passed a resolution today with 2,878 votes in favor of a resolution to make a national security legislation for Hong Kong today. With the passage of the resolution, the National People's Congress Standing Committee will now have to spell out the details to have more deliberations before passing the law and put it in the Annex 3 of the Basic Law, which is Hong Kong's mini constitution. And once they have done that, the law will be effective in Hong Kong.
What does it mean? What does it entail? What does it mean for this special administrative region status for Hong Kong and to the international community?
Well, while the details of the legislation is not made public yet, a lot of people are concerned about whether Hong Kong can still maintain the high degree of autonomy and rather basic human rights will be respected. Because according to the resolution endorsed by the NPC, the law will allow mainland national security agent to set up branches and offices in Hong Kong. Right now, we don't have a full picture of what these national security agents are going to do. And we don't have the full pictures of the scope of these new legislations. So a lot of people are very worried about whether their rights and the human rights and freedom of speech and freedom of the press will be the same as Hong Kong enjoyed before. And this is also one of the very big concerns among the international community.
We're seeing a lot of comment on social media declaring this is the death of Hong Kong or Hong Kong will no longer be the same from now on. So, Teddy, the Lianghui, two sessions, have just been concluded in Beijing today, followed by the Premier's press conference, which was just finished. Did Premier Li Keqiang address the national security law in this press conference?
Yes, indeed. One of the reasons why the national security legislation is such a controversy in Hong Kong is because some people said it is a violation of the one country, two systems principles. which is the model, I mean, Beijing used it to govern Hong Kong. And under these one country, two systems model, Hong Kong is entitled to high degree of autonomy and some principles like Hong Kong people governing Hong Kong. So with the National People's Congress passing a law to Hong Kong, by passing Hong Kong's legislature, a lot of people are asking whether this is still one country, two system, or one country, one system. So Premier Li did address this question during his annual press conference today.
A reporter asked him, is Beijing abandoning one country, two system, right? What did he say?
Well, he says the one country, two systems is still the policy for Beijing, and the principles like Hong Kong people governing Hong Kong is still respected by Beijing. And he clarified that the national security legislations can actually help the implementation of the one country, two systems.
So Teddy, how would you characterize the international backlash?
I think all of us know US Secretary of State already made a statement that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous from mainland China. And the Trump administrations will have to decide what action to take after that. The options include sanctioning officials and cancelling Hong Kong's special trade status, which if they really do that, will seriously affect Hong Kong's economy. And we just know that the Japan's foreign ministry summoned Beijing's ambassador to Tokyo to convey concern over the situation in Hong Kong. So far, the UK and the European Union also issued statements regarding Hong Kong. It seems that Beijing is prepared to face this international backlash. And Beijing is prepared to face the kind of a worst-case scenario, especially in its relations with the United States.
So it looks like Beijing is going to maintain a really, really hardliner stance over this. How far do you think the international community will go regarding Hong Kong's future?
Well, a lot of nations have put up statements and expressed the concerns over Hong Kong, but it remains to be seen whether they will take some actions regarding the legislations. But whether they are going to take any action remains to be seen. Given that China has huge economic relations with a lot of these nations, so it is expected that when these nations, when they are contemplating or when they are thinking the next step to take, they will have to consider the political and economic relations with China.
So it has been almost a week since Beijing announcing its plan to introduce the national security law. Teddy, can you tell us how Hong Kong, in terms of the government and the people?
The NPC voting result is not a surprise, and I don't think Hong Kong and Hong Kong people are shocked by that. Indeed, the city and its people were shocked last week when the NPC plan was made public. Many people are very worried about their future. Probably some of them are thinking whether they should relocate to any other nations to have a better life. And for the government officials are trying to calm the anxiety of the Hong Kong people by convincing them that their lifestyle, their basic human rights will not be affected by the legislations, and saying that this legislation is only targeting at a small number of people. So a large number of people in the city will remain unaffected.
A large amount of law-abiding citizens.
Yeah, this is what they say.
And how did the people respond to it?
Right now, the protests still have not returned to what happened last year. But still, I think people's anxiety and people's frustrations were building up.
Thank you so much for your time, Teddy, for walking us through this national security law. What does it mean for Hong Kong and the international community? International news headlines are dominated by Hong Kong, its relationship with mainland China, and its status as a special administrative region of China because of its national security law passed at the two sessions. But there were other decisions that are crucial to understanding which direction President Xi Jinping and the central government are going to steer China over the coming years. Massive unemployment, one of the biggest economic downturns in modern history. These were the big issues confronting the two sessions. That's why you need to hear from one of the regulars from one of our other podcasts here at SCMP. You can hear political economy editor Zhou Xin each week on a US-China trade war update podcast. But this is his special analysis of what happened at the two sessions, starting with the shock announcement that China would no longer use economic growth measured by GDP to measure its success.
China's GDP, which has been the foremost goal in most government reports in this century, ostentatiously is dropped out from the work report. And many economists say, this is obvious because China has a 6.8 contraction in the first quarter. So if China stick to the original goal of around 6%, which is very unlikely. So which means China is, shifting priority from growth to more important stuff for Beijing when the growth target is apparently out of reach. But if we take a historical point of view, we can say, GDP, only become like the biggest thing for the Communist Party in the recent decades. And even if we look a little bit longer, let's say in President Xi Jinping's point of view, and he often talks about 5,000 years of history of the Chinese nation. And the most important thing is basically, get people something, giving men have the job, give the kids have the education, and older people being taken care of. And that's what President Xi is apparently running after instead of some numbers. He also know exactly, including Premier Li Keqiang, China's GDP numbers. Sometimes are just, made up by local government officials. So this year, 2020, is particularly important for the Communist Party, particularly for Xi Jinping, because he said, from this year on, China will have no absolute poverty. And this sounds like a small deal, but this is a huge deal for Xi, because throughout Chinese history, it's always war, famine, it's always people suffering, and only a very limited period of time can be called a great time of under the emperor XYZ. So if Xi can officially declare that absolute poverty no longer exists in China under his rule, and he will have the historical standing larger, at least on this front, he will have a historical standing larger than Mao Zedong and even Deng Xiaoping. And that's what he is chasing, that he is trying to running after. So he is telling the whole country that, okay, this year, I no longer want you to spend excessively on the bridges leading nowhere or office buildings that no one will take. Spend your time and efforts to looking after the poor people, to looking after those who have lost their jobs. And by the end of this year, I can proudly declare to the whole world, to the nation, that absolute poverty is no longer exist. And this, I think, is a key saying to watch in China. And as for, economic growth, when the coronavirus is under control, I think China has ways to get that back to normal.
Now, it's one thing to say you're going to end absolute poverty in a nation as big as China. But right now, China is facing some of its highest levels of unemployment in the last 40 years. Here's what Zhou Xin has to say about China's job crisis.
Unemployment will be the biggest challenge for the Chinese government this year. It's not Hong Kong, it's not Taiwan, it's not definitely not Xinjiang. It's unemployment of the hundreds of millions of migrant workers that, worried Beijing. Because China has no experience in handling such a wave of unemployment. In the later 1990, Premier Zhu Rongji basically closed lots of state-owned enterprises and throwing about 25 million workers out of jobs, mostly from state-owned factories. And by that time, if you still remember, in China's Rust Belt, angry workers blocked the streets, the whole situation looks very, very dangerous. But at that time, you know, quickly China joined WTO in 2001, and then the private economy is booming. So the 25 million jobs are quickly created. You know, there's an offset. And then another wave of unemployment is during the global financial crisis in 2008. Chen Shih-wen, the Chinese rural planning official, then said about 20 million migrant workers became jobless in the coastal areas because China's export was hit hard by the global financial crisis. And again, the urbanization was at its peak. And you know, every year at that time, you know, 20 million people can settle down in cities. So this, and of course, China's stimulus helped as well. So this problem quickly disappeared. But for now, we are talking about, you know, some people saying 200 million, and some even positive, optimistic estimate still says 50 to 60 million job losses. You know, that's huge. So that's something Beijing is really worried about.
50 million people out of work. That's the population of South Korea. Or if you like, imagine the entire population of Texas and Florida without jobs. And now remember, last year Xi Jinping pledged he would end poverty in China.
Many of the Chinese people get out of poverty because they have their sons or fathers taking all the jobs in cities. And if without this income, these families can easily slip back into poverty. And that's something, you know, Beijing or Xi Jinping cannot tolerate. So this is a real problem for Beijing. And for now also, another problem for the Chinese government is its institutionalized system, the state-backed welfare system, is not designed to handle such a wave of unemployment. For instance, China's state-run jobless benefit system for now cover only 2.3 people, because it's so difficult to get the benefit. You know, you have to be a permanent resident, you have to file numerous paperwork to the government to prove that you really want to work but can't find a job. You know, that's very different from the United States. You know, you just make a claim, then you can get emergency, you know, help immediate from the government. But the Chinese government, the system is designed more for like state-owned enterprises. So it's not for the private sector, certainly not for the 300 million migrant workers who are taking all the jobs. You know, there's one, I just give you one example. To get the unemployment benefit in China, you have to prove previously have 12 months of employment. But for most migrant workers, the average job lasts only 10 months. So which means no one can get this benefits. Of course, China is trying to improve, you know, cut this 12-month period requirement to 6 months, but there's still a long way to go. And this is a huge challenge for China. And that's why I think the government is trying very hard to restart the domestic economy, at least, if they cannot control the export front.
Which brings us to the other historic moment at the two sessions, which is the end of China's five-year plan. And this again is something that Zhou Xin likes to point to as a very important moment in China's history.
Well, the five-year plan is one of the most interesting things about Chinese economy. China is the only major economy that is still doing the five-year plan. You know, this is a legacy from the former Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union collapsed in the second year of the 13th five-year plan. So China is now have a record in the human being history, having the longest five-year plans. Now we are working, this year is the last year of the 13th five-year plan, and next year will be the beginning of the 14th five-year plan.
Five-year plan seems like such a 20th century idea. And China is such a different nation to the old USSR. It's turning out more billionaires for one thing. So why is China still pursuing this idea of a planned economy?
Some people, you know, laughed at this kind of idea. You know, it's why, you know, in 2020, you know, people still spend so much time and efforts to work up a command economy legacy, a five-year plan. And even in China, there are lots of debates. You know, there are a saying in China saying, you know, plans have no other value other than just hanging up on the wall. But actually, this is very important. This five-year plan they have two functions. So first of all is to get, you know, Beijing's concept and strategies and its priorities very clear to the whole country. So the big background is China is going to have its increasing rivalry against the United States. China has to rely more on itself in terms of technology, in terms of domestic market. And Beijing needs kind of a blueprint to tell people, you know, what it wants. And secondly, although it's a plan, it's playing a very important role in guiding the flow of resources in terms of talents, in terms of money. For instance, if China is saying, I really want semiconductor industry to develop, I really want to cut reliance on US chips, well, this sounds like a pipe dream. And then there will be lots of money, lots of resources, lots of planning, mini planning following this. Of course, there will be lots of wasteful investments, there will be lots of inefficiency. We can say half of the plans never worked, but you know, even the rest of the half worked, then China can actually, you know, achieve a lot to overcome the bottlenecks.
And this brings us to the economic policy change to come from the two sessions. China will no longer pursue external demand for exports and will concentrate on its local economy.
This is one of the biggest to take away from the National People's Congress. But maybe it's unfair, a little bit unfair to say that China is changing from one end to one extreme to the other extreme. It's more of like China previously mainly relying on this external demand, and now it's want to lean towards, you know, domestic demand. So it want to have like two legs instead of working with one leg. Let's see what, you know, Xi Jinping will kind of specific policies being rolled out from this mindset. You know, China has to realize its people, its masses, China's you know, the middle class has to make the families certain richer, make these who actually the working class, you know, can afford these things instead of creating one of the most spectacular wealth gaps in the world. You know, even China calls itself a socialist country, but you know that it's a raw, like a kind of capitalism over the past 20 years, two or three decades. So I think it's time now for Xi to gradually to change the situation. Xi is saying we are going to abandon this great international circulation idea, which means putting China as one manufacturing part of this global value chain, importing components from South Korea and Japan and make them and then re-export to the United States and Europe. And this kind of model, China still wants it, but this is no longer going to be the only game for Chinese economy.
China is changing its game plan, and that's going to have an impact on the world. Don't forget you can hear Zhou Xin each week on one of our sister podcasts here at the South China Morning Post, the US-China Trade War Update. Thanks for listening to our Inside China 2-session special. My name is Mimi Lau. Follow our ongoing coverage on SCMP.com, and thanks for rating us and reviewing us on your favorite podcast platform.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to SCMP.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.